There was heroin cough syrup. There was heroin cough syrup for children. Stronger, not weaker. Doctors prescribed heroin for fussy babies and bronchitis and insomnia and nerves and hysteria and all kinds of other vapors. The patients loved it. Best health care ever. Millions got addicted. Corporations made a lot of easy money. Then folks got wise, and by the start of World War I, legal heroin was history. But the corporations never forgot about the easy money. At that point in the story, Noble was melting butter in the egg pan, and he paused the spoon midair as if to emphasize his point. He said, "Remember, this is an active duty DEA agent saying this stuff. We know who causes our problems." The corporations took 80 years to get back in the heroin business. They came in the side door. By that time in history, heroin itself had negative PR. Nothing more than underworld squalor and a bunch of dead rock singers. Kind of sordid. So they made a synthetic version, a chemical copy, like an identical twin, Noble said, looking at Mackenzie. Exactly the same. But now it had a long, clean name, all bright and shiny. It could have been a toothpaste. They put it in neat white pills. What were they for? Getting high, baby. Whatever you want. Except they couldn't put that on the pack. So they said they were for pain. Everyone has pain, right? Not really. Not at first. Pain was not yet a thing. Institutes had to be funded and scholarships endowed. Doctors had to be persuaded. Patients had to be empowered. Which all worked in the end. Pain became a thing. Self-reported and untestable. But suddenly a symptom as valid and meaningful as any other. As a result, America was flooded with hundreds of tons of heroin in purse-size blister packs backed with foil. By that point of the story, they were eating, and Noble was in full flow, like he was teaching a class at the academy. He paused again with his fork mid-air, and he said, "Let me emphasize two very important things. First up, most of this stuff goes to the right people for the right reasons. No one could deny that. It does a lot of good. But equally, no one could deny enough has fallen out around the edges to also cause a lot of harm. Because second up, no one should ever underestimate the appeal of an opiate high. Far as I can tell, it's a beautiful thing. The way they talk about it, it's the best thing ever. For some folks, it hits the spot so hard it reboots their lives." He paused to drink some of Billy's beer. He said, "These are regular folk I'm talking about. American is apple pie. They like the ball game on the radio and country music, not the Grateful Dead. They were seduced by the clean white pill. It made them feel real good, maybe for the first time in their lives. These are plain people, but smart. They soon figured out ways it could make them feel even better. They got the time-release version and broke it up so they got the whole hit at once, a couple times a day, maybe three. Then they discovered the patches. You stick them on your skin, like when you're quitting smoking. A long, clean name on the pack, but it's the same stuff your great-great-grandma lined up for. A nice little maintenance dose. All day long. You could wear two, if you like, or three. But licking them was better. Or sucking them, or wadding them up and chewing them like gum. So much better, in fact, it got easy to want more than the doctor gave you. It got to where you're prepared to drop $10 here and there, now and then, for a couple extras. Then $100 for a whole pack, if need be. Every day, if need be. There are ways to get $100 every day, right? By that point, these folks are already hopeless addicts, but not in their own minds. It's partly a pride thing. Addicts are other people with a dirty needle and a toilet stall. What they have is a pharmaceutical product made in a lab by pretty girls in masks who hold test tubes up to the light with wondrous concern radiating from their clear blue eyes. They've seen it on the television, in the breaks between innings. But in fact, they're running worse risks. Those patches ain't made for licking. 50,000 people died last year. Regular folk, 4 times as many as got killed in gun crimes. He paused again to eat an egg. He said, "But we're winning." "I would say we've already won, in my region at least. We can track prescription pain medication from start to finish. We can take out the bent doctors, and we can train the rest to be cautious about how many days they dispense, and we can eliminate pilferage in the factories and along the transportation vectors. So right now, the black market is virtually dead, and the medical market is heavily scrutinized. Total success. Except the previous bonanza left us with millions of addicts. Regular folk, remember? They thought a dirty needle and a toilet stall was not their fate. But it's a free market. When we bit down, the price of pills went up because of supply and demand. What used to be $10 was suddenly 50. It was a crisis. Suddenly, regular cartel powder up from Mexico looked like an irresistible bargain. Remember, deep down, it's the same chemical. These folks are canny shoppers. None of them ever paid sticker for a car. And numbers don't lie, even when they factored in the cost to their dignity. With the dirty needles and the toilet stalls and all? Hey, the powder was still a bargain. We swapped one problem for another. He paused again to put his silverware together and push his plate away. He took a long drink from his bottle. He said, "But overall, it was good news for us. We liked the new problem better. The regular cartel powder is harder to hide. We can follow it better. From our point of view, it was like the system had just swallowed a barium meal. Whole networks lit up like neon. Standards got less precise. Our job got easier. But not everywhere. A certain part of Montana, for instance. Nothing lit up at all. We couldn't see incoming product. No cartel powder going there. So what happened to their addicts? Did they all cold turkey? Or die? Or is someone else supplying? That's something I would want to know. So I went out to check. I discovered nothing of value, except one trivial thing. Anecdotally, along the way, I discovered I had spooked a low-level operative who triggered a long-standing pact with a friend who was also a low-level operative, but in another network. The pact was both of them would immediately get the hell out the very first time either one of them heard a whisper of trouble, which was the smart play, no question. I'm guessing this wasn't their first rodeo. These things always fall apart in the end, and they always fall hardest on the lowest-level guys. Better to get out early. Which is why Billy ain't coming home. Billy was the friend from Mule Crossing, Wyoming. He's in the wind with his pal from Billings, Montana. Mackenzie said,
"Where have they gone, do you think?"
"A new hustle," Noble said. "Someplace else."
"Are you looking for them?"
"We're not about to call out the National Guard. We'll put their names and their faces in the system. Reacher said, surely the pact implies they worked for the same network, not different. One whisper made two guys run. Maybe what looked like two different networks were really two parts of the same thing. Maybe, Noble said. I don't know much about them. It's an opaque network, remember. That's why I went. Odds are the guy in Montana was just a street corner dealer, or the rural equivalent. Odds are Billy was, too. Business schools call it customer-facing, and some of those guys have been to business school. Not guys like Billy and his pal, people who own guys like Billy and his pal. So what next for you? I'm going to find clean sheets and make up a bed. I can't claim lodging expenses if there's a bed in the house. Then what? Back to some real work. This all was a waste of time. The government got a house. Two houses, Noble said. Don't forget Billings, Montana. I bet we won't be able to sell either one of them. Mackenzie said,
is there any way you could let us know if you find Billy?
Noble shook his head. He said, I can't help with your sister. I'm sorry, ma'am. But what have you got? A lot of guesswork and hope for the best. A federal manhunt costs $1 million a day. They need a very good reason, which you can't give them. You got a lot of probable and not much cause. Mackenzie didn't answer. Noble said, but I wish you the best of luck. Chapter 24 They left Noble in the house and drove back to Laramie, with Reacher sprawled across the rear seat, and Mackenzie upright in the front, and Bramall at the wheel, one-handed. They agreed on the chain hotel Reacher and Bramall had used the night before. It had proved adequate, except for no coffee. Reacher said the diner he had found was a good substitute. Bramall agreed. He had found it, too. He said breakfast there was excellent.
But then what?
Mackenzie said.
What do we do after breakfast? What's our next move? We have nothing now.
Thanks to the DEA, Bramall said. Trust them to start a stampede. We have more than some folks, Reacher said. I agree, losing Billy is an inconvenience, but it's worse for others, like that lady up near the old homestead, even all the way out there. She needed something bad today. She was getting scratchy. She was waiting for Billy, but he isn't coming. So what next for her? Tomorrow she'll be desperate. She'll come looking, surely. She'll come to town. They all will. If Rose is an addict, she'll come to us. They met in the lobby at 8 in the morning. Bramall was in a fresh shirt, and Mackenzie was in a fresh blouse. Reacher's clothes were a day old, but he felt okay in their company. He had used a whole bar of soap in the shower. They walked up to the diner and got a table. Mackenzie was okay with it. She said,
maybe 6 weeks ago the price of pills had gone especially high, and that's why she had to sell her ring to afford them?
Maybe, Reacher said.
I want it to be pills, she said, not needles in a toilet stall.
Of course.
I'm sure Special Agent Noble was speaking broadly when he said, there are no pills on the black market anymore. There must be some.
Reacher said nothing. Mackenzie said,
before this is over, I'll want to know why it happened.
Probably our fault, Reacher said. Depends on the wound she got. Could have been a scratch, but if it was something serious on the battlefield, with the medics under fire and so on, then she'll have gotten a morphine jab ahead of a rough evacuation. Then, maybe another morphine jab ahead of triage, and another while she was waiting for surgery. And then she got 2 weeks in a recovery room with a big tub of opioid pain medication by the bed. She was probably an addict before she left the hospital.
Depending on the wound, maybe it's still painful. Maybe that's why she needs the pills. Or the powder now, with the needles in the toilet stall. If Agent Noble is right.
Did your sister wear silver clothes?
Why?
Porterfield's neighbor might have seen her in his car. She remembered a silvery color.
Was it winter?
A month before the start of spring.
You can get winter coats in silver.
Almost like foil, like a high-tech material. Would she wear that color?
I might,
Mackenzie said. Richard thought about it. The hair, the eyes, the face with a silver foil coat. She would look like the picture on the back of a shiny magazine. An exact replica. They drove to the university geography department and took another look at the giant book of maps. They traced the settlements westward from the mule crossing turn. First came Billy's place, south of the dirt road, and then Porterfield's, north of it, and then his neighbor's, south again. They had seen all of those. Beyond them lay 12 more places, 6 each side of the road, altogether stretching 40 long miles into the mountains. Then the dirt road ended. No way out except to turn around. Not really a bowl, not really a valley. Just a chain of rising foothills with a road that quit when the mountains came. Mackenzie said,
You think she's in there somewhere?
Reacher said, She was either living with Porterfield or she was visiting with him on a regular basis, yet no one ever saw her except maybe one occasion. If she lived anywhere else, she would have to drive in and out through Mule Crossing every single time. More people would have seen her, surely. Maybe even the old guy in the post office. But no one ever did. She must have been driving there and back the other way, deeper into the hills. A buck gets 10, she's there right now. Where else would she go?
She doesn't own a car, Bramall said. Not according to the Wyoming DMV or any other state.
She camps out in abandoned ranch houses. Either she finds cars or steals them. She doesn't care whose name is on the title. All a car has to do is start up when she needs it.
I want to go there,
Mackenzie said.
Back to Mule Crossing. It's like the neck of a funnel. If she's in there, she's got to come out sooner or later. I want to be there when she does.
If I'm right, Reacher said.
If you're wrong, we'll find her in town tonight. Or tomorrow.
They pulled over and sat in the car near the old post office, in a spot where they would get a good head-on view of anything coming down the dirt road, just before the turn, where everyone would slow right down and look first one way and then the other, carefully, before making the left or the right on the pavement, close enough for faces. At first it was awkward. Reacher figured they were all having the same trouble, picturing exactly what it was they expected to see. They knew the theory. The lack of Billy would draw the addicts out. But what would that look like? Reacher had seen his share of movie trailers, The Walking Dead, all kinds of zombies. He realized he was expecting some kind of apocalyptic vision. The first candidate approached out of the west in an ancient pickup truck that was lurching and bouncing and trailing a dust cloud a mile long. Not Rose Sanderson. The driver turned out to be a thin-faced man with a turned-down mouth, as disapproving as an old-time preacher. Maybe an addict, maybe not. He looked left and right and turned toward Colorado. The dust cloud settled. They waited. From the back seat, Reacher asked Mackenzie, "Where were you when Rose was at West Point?" She turned around.
"University of Chicago," she said. "Then Princeton for postgrad."
"Studying what?"
"English literature."
"Different,
I know."
"Not so different. Some of them can read at West Point now, if you take it slow and point to the letters." She smiled.
"I didn't mean it like that," she said. "I know Rose is as smart as I am, obviously. It's a scientific fact. I mean, she was prepared to kill people, and I wasn't."
"That was the big dispute?"
"It was never a big dispute. We never fell out, but things happened so fast back then. All of a sudden, Rose was in the army, and that was a serious thing. Our resources were stretched thin. She was hardly ever home for 9 years. I was never told where she was. I couldn't go visit. Most of the time, I couldn't even call. Meanwhile, I was working. I got married. That's how it was. We had real lives, like everyone else with a sibling."
"Except she was prepared to kill people and you weren't."
"I don't mean she wanted to or planned to. It was an ethical discussion, that's all. We were 18. I wasn't saying it had to be all or nothing. In fact, it never is. No one says always or never. Everyone says sometimes. But her sometimes were not the same as mine. She would pull the trigger before I would. Which was okay. Maybe I was wrong. Maybe I was naive. It wasn't the difference of opinion that bothered me. We always had different opinions. It was that she had thought about it. Seriously, carefully, and decided, yes, she could do it. For real. Which changed her a little. She changed herself by deciding it. For the first time ever, I felt not the same as her."
Reacher said nothing. She turned back. They waited. The second candidate for the apocalypse was the woman who had given the strawberry pie to Cy Porterfield, his neighbor, second place on the left. She was in a battered Jeep SUV. She looked left and right and turned toward Laramie, maybe heading to the market. Maybe planning to spend time in the fruit aisle. The third vehicle they saw came from behind them. It turned in off the two-lane and passed them by and set out down the dirt road west. It was a pickup truck. On the front, it had snowplow pistons bolted to the frame. Chapter 25. Bramall looked a question, and Mackenzie and Reacher both nodded, so he started the engine and bumped up on the dirt road. A unanimous decision. The obvious play. It cost them nothing to follow the pickup at least as far as Billy's place. Their eyes would be on the neck of the funnel throughout. Any random driving dead would pass right by, close enough to touch. Certainly, close enough to eyeball in great detail. Then in the end, if the pickup kept on going, they could coast to a stop and turn around and call the snowplow pistons a weird coincidence.
"What if it turns in?"
Mackenzie said.
"Maybe it's a competitor just heard the news," Reacher said. "Maybe he wants Billy's Rolodex. Maybe snow thawing is a very competitive business."
"Suppose it's Billy himself."
"I'm sure the boy detective changed the locks, or glued them up, or whatever they do now. Either one of which will make our boy good and mad. He'll get all cross and frustrated. He'll go get his deer rifle from his truck to shoot the locks. He'll be standing right there on the porch with it when we show up, finger on the trigger."
"Only if we turn in, too."
"He hasn't heard the phone message. He'll think we're Mormons, or whichever it is, let women join in now."
By that point, they had caught up to about 100 yards behind the pickup, which would be considered a very close pursuit in such a vast landscape, but they were invisible because of the dust cloud. The pickup's mirrors couldn't see them. They rolled on in secret convoy. The pronghorn herd was grazing a new patch of pasture. 2 miles gone, less than a minute remaining at their current speed. The pickup slowed. They saw it loom large and ghost-like in the cloud ahead. Bramall backed off. The pickup braked, lights flaring all the way down to walking speed, and then it turned a wide, slow left into the mouth of Billy's driveway. "Go for it," Reacher said. "Go after him." Bramall looked at Mackenzie. She hesitated. Reacher said, "He hasn't heard the phone message. He doesn't know who we are. We're just three random people." Mackenzie said,
"He knows where Rose is."
Bramall turned in. No dust on the driveway. It was a forest track, all rock and grit and gravel. Now the Toyota was plainly visible. They hung back. They saw the pickup through the trees, 200 yards ahead of them, flashing through the sun and the shadows. "Stupid to run and come right back," Reacher said.
"Maybe he wants his money," Mackenzie said.
They rolled on, keeping pace. The pickup drove through the final curve and out of sight. Another 50 yards, it would be out of the woods. Then the last 100 over the beaten red dirt to the house. "Let me out here," Reacher said. "I'll walk the rest of the way in the trees. I can cut the corner. I can get there faster."
"Is that smart?"
Bramall said. "It's smarter than sticking together. A good squad never bunches up. Too big of a target." Bramall stopped the car and Reacher slid out. Bramall drove on. Reacher watched him go, and then he threaded his way into the woods and set out on what he hoped was a straight line to the last tree before the house. He got close just in time to see the pickup drive across the last of the dirt and park near the house. He waited. 100 yards away, in the mouth of the driveway, he saw Bramall roll to a stop. His Toyota was well hidden. No glint of paint, no gleam of chrome. All completely covered with thick red dust. Better than desert camouflage. He waited. The pickup's engine turned off. The driver's door opened. A guy got out. He was young, early 20s maybe, 6 feet tall, couple 100 pounds, maybe more, most of it fat. He was a big, shapeless guy. He looked slow and clumsy. Not Billy. Billy wore a 32 waist and a 30 leg and an 8.5 shoe. The big guy took a ring of keys from his pocket and stared at it like he had never seen one before. He carried it up on the porch and walked to the door. He chose a key and bent down to the hole. He looked puzzled. He touched the keyhole with his fingertip. Then he straightened up and spun around as if he was suddenly certain someone was behind him. With a camera, maybe, for kids to watch on their phones and laugh. Reacher stepped out of the trees. He walked across the dirt and waved a come on to Bramall. The guy by the door watched him all the way, not reacting, still looking puzzled. Reacher stepped up on the porch. Up close, the guy looked harmless. His shape made his clothes tight and smooth. There were no unexplained lumps or bumps in his pockets. He was unarmed. He was very young. He was no kind of a physical threat. Maybe not the smartest kid, either. Not a whole lot going on behind his eyes. Reacher said, "Who are you?" The kid said,
"Well, I came by to get something."
Which was technically non-responsive, but Reacher let it go. Bramall and Mackenzie stepped up on the porch. The kid looked at them, still puzzled. Reacher looked at the keyhole. There was a bead of glue in it. The boy detective had changed one lock, maybe at the back, and glued all the others. Efficiency, saving taxpayer money. The kid said, Who are you? Richa said, I asked first.
I'm doing nothing wrong.
Just tell me your first name.
It's Mason.
Okay, Mason. It's good to meet you. Why are you here?
I came by to get something.
For who?
For me. Billy said I could have it.
Who is Billy? The kid said.
He's my brother.
Is he?
Well, half.
Where is he now?
I don't know. He ran off again.
Has he done that before?
2 times that I can remember. This time he called me and told me where he left his truck. He said I could have it. And something in his house, too.
Where was the truck?
Up near Casper.
Reacher nodded. Nearer Mule Crossing than Billings, Montana. The other guy had driven more miles than Billy.
Why?
Must have been their agreed-upon vector. They were planning to head southeast, through Nebraska, and away.
He said, what kind of something did he leave in the house?
I'm not sure I should tell you.
Was it money in a box?
The kid looked surprised.
Yes, he said. In a shoebox.
Did he want you to bring it to him?
No, sir, it's for me. He said he's already with a guy who has plenty.
Where?
He didn't tell me. He wouldn't. No way. He used to say to me, Mason, if you ever have to run, you tell no one where you're going, not even me.
You're completely sure he didn't tell you?
Yes, sir.
What does Billy do for a living?
He works a snow plow.
What about the summer?
I think he buys and sells things.
What kind of things does he sell?
Just things, like flea market things.
Where does he sell them?
I think all around, wherever people are who want to buy them.
Do you know any of his customers?
No.
Have you ever seen a woman who looks like my friend here?
No.
Do you know what an accessory is?
Something you put on your truck.
Also a legal word, Reacher said. It means if you know a secret and you don't tell, then you go to jail too. Billy has strayed far from the narrow path of righteousness, I'm afraid. He has made some poor choices in his life. The government seized this house yesterday. A federal agent put glue in the lock. That's what they do now. So this is our last chance to help you, Mason. If you know where Billy is, you better tell us, right now.
I don't know where Billy is, the brother said, kind of happily.
But don't worry, he'll be back in a year or two. That's what happened the last 2 times.
Reacher looked at Bramall, who shrugged, then at Mackenzie, who nodded. She believed the kid, who said,
how do I get in the house?
You don't, Reacher said. No point. The money is long gone. It was in a federal evidence locker before you woke up this morning. But you can keep the truck. Get a blade for the plow and you could set up in business. They watched the kid drive away. Mackenzie stayed on the porch and looked at the view. The wide, empty plains on the right. The old post office and the fireworks store. The pronghorns about a mile away. The red road still neatly scraped, still nicely cambered. On the left, the low, jagged peaks, like miniature mountain ranges. She said,
logically, we should keep on going. She's not here. She's out at Porterfield's place, which is next. She's not at the Pie Lady's place, which comes after that, so logically, we could just keep on going and then stop before the fourth place. We'd be closer. Nothing could happen behind us. It would still all be ahead of us.
If Reacher is right, Bramall said, which he might not be,
then why has no one seen her?
Bramall didn't answer. Reacher said,
I guess the gift of the truck was a cowboy kind of thing. Billy was making sure someone looked after his best horse, so to speak, come what may. All that kind of good stuff. But $10,000 in a box is different. That's a lot of money to give away. I don't think he wanted to. I think he was out on the road when he got the call from Montana. Too far from home to come back and get it. The pact meant he had no time. He had to go to Casper immediately. And given the direction the other guy was driving from Billings, we have to assume they carried on east through Nebraska. And if we time it from Scorpio's first voicemail, this all was at least 48 hours ago. They're in Chicago by now. Except I don't think they went to Chicago. I don't think they would have felt at home there. My guess is they turned south for Oklahoma. They could make some kind of living there, or the same kind of living.
Possible, Bramall said.
Mackenzie said, but Special Agent Noble will never be able to figure that out because he'll never know where the truck was found, because of our decision to give it to the brother.
Bramall said,
our?
Nothing to be ashamed of. I'm sure it was done with the best of intentions. Job creation is a wonderful thing. But I want Special Agent Noble to have a shot at finding Billy, because I think he would tell us if he does. Why wouldn't he? I think we should call him. I think we should tell him about Oklahoma.
It was only a guess, Bramall said.
Based on a fact, she said, which Noble hasn't got.
He might guess different.
At least he'll get a chance to.
You really want me to call him?
I think we should.
Grandma looked at Reacher. Reacher said, he cooked, after all. Normally we would send a note of some kind. Grandma took out his tortoiseshell reading glasses and a small notebook. He opened it with his thumb. Reacher said, you have Noble's number in there? Bramall said,
just the Western Division switchboard.
He dialed and played phone tag for a long minute, saying the name over and over again with variations. Special Agent Kirk Noble, Special Agent Noble, Kirk Noble. Eventually the guy himself must have come on the line, because Bramall reminded him who he was in terms of the bacon and egg dinner. And then he said now there was very strong reason to believe the fugitives had gone to Oklahoma. Evidently, Noble asked to speak to Reacher. Bramall passed the phone. Noble said, there's a problem with Porterfield. Chapter 26. Noble said, I typed it up, word for word, based on what you told me. And then I ran it through some software we have, which automatically checks against our existing databases to see if we know the names already, for other reasons. And Seymour Porterfield came up blocked. I dug around and found three separate files on the guy, all locked, all needing high-level passwords. Reacher said, what kind of a guy would get a file like that? A source of information, Noble said. It's a security measure. Interesting. I need to know who Porterfield was. He had an expensive kitchen. I need you to tell me what you know. I don't know anything about Porterfield. He wore blue jeans a lot and had an eye for decor, but I don't really care. He's not why I'm here. One of the files was about Porterfield and a second person. Judging by the codes, the second person was a woman. I can't read the date on the file, but the sequencing suggests it was first opened about 2 years ago and last looked at by someone not long before Porterfield died. Interesting, Reacher said again. How deep in your system are these files? Very deep. But I don't think they're DEA originals. I think we got copied in as a courtesy by someone else. Who? It's a weird code. Not the FBI or the ATF. It's like what we used to get when we had special forces deployed in Colombia. Not a remote source, you understand. Somewhere fairly near our main office.
Okay, Reacher said. I understand. Don't forget to call Oklahoma.
He clicked off, told the others. Mackenzie said,
Does this help us?
I don't know, Reacher said. Who Porterfield was 2 years ago doesn't necessarily tell us where Rose is now. We shouldn't invest too much time in it. I guess we could go pull off the road ahead of the fourth place, and I could make a call from there while we were waiting.
They parked on the slope of the shoulder at an angle, like a cop with a radar gun. Ahead of them were 12 more homesteads, all widely separated and out of sight, all along 40 more miles of the dirt road, and then nothing. No one was coming. Reacher borrowed Bramall's phone and dialed the same ancient number from memory. The same woman answered.
West Point, she said. Superintendent's office, how may I help you?
This is Reacher.
Hello, Major.
I need to speak with the soup.
You don't know his name, do you?
I guess not, currently.
It's General Simpson. He'll be happy you called. He has information for you. Wait one, Major.
There were clicks and dead air, and then the soup's voice came on the line. It said, Major?
Reacher said, General?
He didn't use the name Simpson, just in case it wasn't. West Point culture was full of practical jokes, and although he very much doubted the woman who answered the phone would set him up, he couldn't be sure. The soup said,
What progress are you making?
Some, Reacher said. I think I'm close to the right location.
Which is where?
Bottom right-hand corner of Wyoming.
So, she went home.
Not exactly, but not far away. I found trace evidence in a house in a place called Mule Crossing. She was there about a year and a half ago. My sense is she's still in the general neighborhood.
The soup said, There's something you need to know. It might be important.
Out of curiosity, I tried to take a look at Sanderson's service record and medical file. I couldn't get in. They're sealed tighter than a duck's butt on a choppy day. I think your people did it.
My people?
Military police?
When?
Hard to tell exactly. Not recently. But after she left the service, almost certainly. 2 years ago, possibly.
Okay, Reacher said. Now guess what I was calling about.
How could I? The house where I found evidence was owned by a guy who also has a sealed file in a government database. 3 sealed files, in fact, one of which was first opened around 2 years ago and features the guy with a woman. Apparently, they are not native files. The folks at the database think the agency in question was copied in as a courtesy by another agency.
Do they know which one?
They hinted at the Pentagon.
I find that interesting, the soup said. As you knew I would. But you didn't call just to entertain me. You want me to do something.
Who do you know down there?
A couple of people.
Do they owe you?
How big of a risk would they be taking?
Not much. This thing went cold a year and a half ago. It's ancient history now. And they don't have to give us chapter and verse. Just confirm or deny if Sanderson is the woman in the file with the guy who owned the house. His name was Seymour Porterfield. Social Security should show a county sheriff's notification of death around the start of spring last year.
He's dead.
It's Wyoming. He was eaten by a bear. Reacher spelled Porterfield's names, first and last. The soup repeated them back.
Thank you, General, Reacher said.
You can call me back on this number. My partner, Mr. Bramall, will answer.
Thank you, Major.
Reacher said, Sir, is your name Simpson?
Correct,
the soup said.
Sean Simpson.
Yes, sir, Reacher said, purely out of habit. He clicked off and gave the phone back to Bramall, who plugged it in to charge. They waited an hour on the shoulder and saw no one coming except a small herd of elk who came out of the trees on one side of a gulch and into the trees on the other. Overhead, black birds of prey hovered motionless, high in the sky. The road stayed empty.
I'm sorry,
Mackenzie said.
I did it again.
Every idea looks like a good idea, until it turns out wrong.
Neither of us had a better idea, Reacher said.
Maybe it's a good thing if we don't see her. It would mean she doesn't need what Billy was selling. It would mean she's okay. Someone stole her ring. You said so yourself.
Best case.
Which sometimes happens.
Sometimes, Reacher said.
How often?
More than never, less than always.
Oi,
Bramall said. He pointed. There was a dust cloud on the road ahead, in the west, way far in the distance on the rising horizon. There was a tiny dot at its head, smoothed by the haze, but coming on fast. They waited. The dot grew bigger, and the cloud spun and howled behind it, furiously and endlessly generating itself anew, exactly the shape of a parachute, but infinitely long, hanging together with some kind of internal aerodynamic constraint, before finally going limp and succumbing to wind and gravity and drifting back to Earth.
Stand by,
Bramall said. He pulled his phone off the charger, ready to take a photograph. They waited. An SUV flashed by, moving fast, an ancient model, boxy and battered and square, covered with rust and red dust so thick it looked baked on. The window glass was just as bad, except the front windshield, which had two smeared arcs from the wipers where the dust was thinner. Through them, they got a fractured, split-second glimpse inside. Just a dull and hazy impression. A small figure flinching away. A silvery color. Chapter 27 Bramall swung off the shoulder and took off in pursuit like the highway patrol. The truck up ahead was still moving fast. The road ran straight for long stretches, then dipped through hollows and rose over knolls and curved out of sight, but the dust cloud was always there, showing the way. The big Toyota growled along, pattering hard over the rough surface, going plenty fast itself. But their quarry wasn't slowing any. In fact, it was speeding up. At times, the cloud between them grew half a mile long, and then it was gone. The Toyota came leaning out of a long, fast curve through the last of the dust into clear air, pure and bright and empty for miles ahead. No truck. Nothing there. Behind them, the severed cloud swayed in the wind and pulled off the road and died in the scrub. Bramall stopped.
She turned off, Reacher said. There's no dust on the ranch roads. What's back there?
Bramall made a U-turn, shoulder to shoulder, and went back to see.
Driveway on the left, Mackenzie said. I think. It's hard to be sure.
The pie lady, Reacher said. Porterfield's neighbor, we were here yesterday. We almost missed it then.
But the pie lady is out. We saw her go.
Bramall turned in on the track and drove, the same way as the day before, but faster, twisting and rising through the trees more than 3 miles, during which distance they saw nothing and no one. And then, as before, all of a sudden the trees opened up and the Toyota burst out on the flat acre with the long view east and the one-story house with its brown boards and its ancient millwork and its old church pew. Nothing there. No battered old SUV caked with dust. Nothing moving. No sound. Mackenzie said,
"There must be other ways out of here, like the places I showed you yesterday."
Bramall drove on, in a wide, bumpy circle, all the way around the house, around the outbuildings, always tight to the tree line. They saw three separate forest tracks running onward through the trees. One went due west, one went south, and one split the difference between. They were like trails for hikers or hunters, all worn and beaten down, all gnarled with roots and rocks, all dappled with gentle sunlight, all curving out of sight, all narrow, but good enough for a boxy old SUV. It was impossible to say which one had just been used. The ground was bone dry. There were tire tracks everywhere, sharp in the dust.
"Want to gamble?" Grandma said.
"Waste of time," Reacher said. "These trails have too many turns. The odds would get impossible. Plus, your truck is bigger than hers. We'd get stuck."
"If it was her," Grandma said.
"Suppose it was."
"Doesn't matter which way she went," Mackenzie said. "The question is why she went. What happened?"
"We scared her," Reacher said. "We were waiting on the shoulder. We could have been state police. She didn't want us to catch her, so she pulled off the road and tracked back on some weird Forest Service route only she knows. Now she's laying low someplace, trying to figure out what she wants to do next."
"Where?"
"Within about 1,000 square miles of right here, in a spot we'll never find." Mackenzie was quiet a beat. Then she said,
"Did you see the silver?"
Bramall said,
"An impression."
"What did you make of it?"
"A coat,"
Bramall said,
"with a hood."
"But tight," Reacher said. "I thought like athletic wear, the kind of thing they peel off before the race."
"Did it look like foil?"
"Partly,"
Bramall said.
"Maybe the trim."
Mackenzie said,
"Why didn't she want us to catch her?"
"She didn't know it was you," Reacher said. "She didn't see your face. Her windows were dusty and so were ours, and when she came by head-on, she was looking the other way. It wasn't an emotional decision, it was practical. She thought we were cops. Maybe she's the kind of person who can't let a cop see the inside of her car."
"If it was her,"
Bramall said.
"Because she's an addict,"
Mackenzie said. "Worst case," Reacher said.
"Which happens?"
"More than never, less than always."
"Which way are you leaning?"
"Hope for the best, plan for the worst."
"Seriously?"
"I'm thinking about Seymour Porterfield," Reacher said. "We're assuming Billy took over his business, whereupon that kind of thing usually triggers some kind of vigorous expansion afterward, which seems to be the whole reason businesses get taken over in the first place, all because someone else sees missed opportunities. And this is not a type of business that ever gets smaller anyway, it only gets bigger. Therefore, long story short, on a theoretical basis, for a number of reasons, we could expect law enforcement to see Billy as a bigger proposition now than Porterfield ever was. But the boy detective, as good as told us, he isn't even interested in a person like Billy. He said he was going to put his face in the system. That's code for letting him walk away, because he's too boring to talk to. Whereas, on the other hand, the even less interesting Seymour Porterfield has his own sealed file at the Pentagon." Bramall said,
"Could be nothing."
He might once have had small-time connections in Central America. The military wrote everything down. His file might be one word long. You know what that stuff was like. You were probably there. Why would a one-word file be sealed? Bramall said,
I don't know.
What do we actually know for sure about Porterfield?
Very little.
What impression did you get?
Like the neighbors said, a rich guy from out of state come to find himself, maybe writing a novel.
Nice life.
You bet.
You liked his house.
I could live there.
He had everything a person could need, Reacher said, including granite countertops and his very own file at the Pentagon. In fact, he had three files at the Pentagon, one of which seems to cover some kind of a joint enterprise with an unspecified woman during the last 6 months of his life, on top of which is the broken window in his house, which looked like government work, which is ridiculous until it isn't. Plus, the guy got eaten by a bear or a mountain lion, either of which is highly unlikely, and all of which lead to wild speculations about what exactly happened during those last 6 months, especially toward the end. Maybe Rose ran just now because a year and a half ago she learned not to trust expensive black vehicles full of people. So to answer Mrs. McKenzie's original question, I guess right now I'm leaning slightly away from the worst case. Worst cases are usually very banal. This thing feels more complex than that. McKenzie said,
You think Porterfield wasn't the man you thought he was?
He could have been 10 times worse. Now I don't know for sure. Which is the interesting part. It makes it equally possible he was 10 times better. Bramall said,
If he was, how would Arthur Scorpio know his name?
Hugh Billy, maybe. Billy was Porterfield's neighbor, just as much as the pie lady. They all talk. Maybe Scorpio liked to hear neighborhood gossip.
He had 10 grand in his shoebox.
Maybe to live on while he wrote his novel. Bramall didn't answer. His phone rang. He answered and listened, then gave the phone to Reacher.
It's General Simpson, he said. For you.
Reacher put the phone to his ear. The soup said, Porterfield was a U.S. Marine. Chapter 28 The soup said, Anything below the surface is locked down tight. But we know from Social Security and other unclassified sources that the Seymour Porterfield who died in Wyoming last year was an Ivy League postgrad who joined the Marine Corps the day after 9/11. He was the perfect recruit, a real poster boy. He went to Iraq in the first wave as a lieutenant in a rifle company. He didn't last more than a month. He was an early casualty. The injury is unspecified. He was honorably discharged, and he returned to civilian life. Back then, the Marines could still afford mental health counseling during that type of separation. There's a note that says Porterfield seemed happy to resume academic pursuits and had realistic expectations of a future inheritance, both cash and real estate, such that no one had to worry very much, least of all the Marine Corps. Then he dropped off the government radar for a very long time. Until, Reacher said, 2 years ago, some office deep in the Pentagon got a brand new case, something to do with Porterfield. We don't know what. We think they dug up his original service file for background and then sealed it, which usually means something. Meanwhile, they were also opening a second new file about Porterfield and a woman. That's what we can see so far. Three files, like you said. Was Sanderson the woman?
We don't know yet. That's below the surface. Are you still looking? Discreetly,